In this week's Capital Connection, our topics are efforts to combat human trafficking and bills to update the state's sexual assault laws. I'm Jackie Yamanaka. To begin, I joined Attorney General Tim Fox in his office to talk about human trafficking, an issue that's not new.
Well, today we actually have called it modern-day slavery. So it's it can be anything from forcing people to work. Probably the more evident thing that we see in the newspapers anymore is sex trafficking. But at any time when someone loses their freedom and are exploited, typically for money, that's modern-day slavery, and it's human trafficking as well.
And you've talked about it. It's basic. The basic tenet is a loss of an individual's freedom.
Absolutely. And it can happen in many ways. Folks typically have their identity stripped from them. Oftentimes, they're physically and emotionally injured. Essentially, they feel helpless. And it can be psychologically something very difficult for them to get out of, and it can have life-lasting scars on them in many different ways.
There may be folks who think, okay, I understand the definition, that happens elsewhere. Does it happen in Montana?
It sure does, and that's unfortunate. We have folks who are trafficked in and out of Montana for various labor-type trafficking, and also for sex trafficking. We have many situations that, because we're in law enforcement here at the Department of Justice, we're aware of. And I think what we've seen in recent years is a heightened awareness of the public. Whether or not that means in Montana we've had an increase in human trafficking, it's hard to tell, but we have had an increase in the number of cases that we've handled and the number of victims we've rescued.
Can you talk a little bit about some of those cases? I don't know if our listeners are aware of what is happening in terms of the law enforcement side.
Sure. I know that in Missoula, several years ago, there were two girls that were trafficked. Basically, they were befriended by some older adult males in the mall, where teenage kids typically want to hang out. Both of these individuals, they were girls, were minors. And we know this because ultimately they were rescued in a different state, and they'd been trafficked for sex for a number of months. And we also know that one of them was able to recover and have a productive life. The other one is kind of dropped off the radar. But these are Montana kids, and so that's just one example, but it's a horrendous example, and we want to make sure that we stop it.
Are there particular segments of our population here in Montana that are more vulnerable? Certainly, you mentioned youth. I'm wondering,
sure,
about individuals who are in poverty. They're homeless. Maybe they're on the reservations. I don't know.
Well, certainly people who may have disabilities, kids who are having problems at school or at home. But the example I gave you, one of those girls in Missoula came from a great family. There were really no known issues. These girls were groomed. They were complimented by these men. They were given gifts, made to feel important, feel like they were loved. And so in the sex trafficking realm, it can happen to anybody. And the labor trafficking realm, it can happen to anybody.
What role does social media play, whether it's texting or Facebook or things like that, in terms of being able to cross state lines and to perhaps reach more youth or more individuals?
Sure. So human trafficking tends to be very mobile, and it's difficult. It kind of is underground, and the Internet has become a way in which human trafficking, unfortunately, has become more prominent. Particularly sex trafficking. And, of course, our Division of Criminal Investigation does a number of operations where we go undercover, oftentimes posing as individuals on the Internet. And, unfortunately, there are Internet sites that exploit people and make money And we just learned, unfortunately, that one of those sites, which had been sued by some victims of sex trafficking, that case was thrown out by a lower federal court, and the Supreme Court just recently refused to take the case up on appeal, which leaves the lower court decision standing. So we have to be vigilant. You know, as parents, we need to make sure that we're involved in our kids' lives, obviously, and to some extent, I think that we need to monitor their activities on the internet. But you're right. Modern technology is used by criminals for criminal operations, and human trafficking seems to be one of them.
You know, we talked a little bit about one of the hallmarks for human trafficking is that loss of freedom. But what do you say when folks are in desperate situations, whether they're suffering from addiction or poverty, and so they turn to, for example, the sex trade for money, right, and then find themselves then part of this human trafficking network that's happening underground?
You know, more often than not, it's not something of choice. Oftentimes, it's obviously children, and I would present to you that a child cannot make that choice. These people, these sex traffickers in particular, prey on individuals and want to try to make them feel like it's their choice. And then once they get into what they call the life, it's difficult to get out for them because they've been manipulated in so many ways that they have a very difficult time leaving that life. So I would suggest to you that it's not a choice, that it certainly is a horrendous and heinous crime that these individuals are committing. The traffickers themselves, perhaps, might try to justify it in their own mind, but ultimately it is a crime against humanity.
Now, certainly, as you mentioned, because of social media, these crimes can cross not only state boundaries but also international boundaries. Can you talk about the partnership then for the State Department of Justice as well as the federal and local,
sure,
and perhaps international jurisdictions?
So each of the 50 states have state, I guess, equivalents to the Division of Criminal Investigation. And we stay in touch and communicate in very many ways with not only federal law enforcement, but international law enforcement. And, of course, we have several borders, Canada and Mexico, and we're a very fluid country in terms of travel with coastlines and airlines and all of that. And so we've had a number of individuals here in my office from Asian countries and elsewhere who talk about their efforts and collaboration in trying to stop trafficking. We see that third world countries are particularly susceptible to trafficking of individuals for labor or sex, and that's certainly something that happens all over the world, and that's why this is one of the fastest growing criminal activities, I think second only to drug trafficking, in terms of the amount of people who are exploited and the amount of money that is made.
What do you do about the demand? I mean, certainly these sex traffickers would not be doing what they do if there were not a customer on the
right
other end.
Well, here at the Department of Justice, we not only focus on bringing the perpetrators of trafficking to justice, but also the Johns, if you will, and the others who are the market, if you will, for those criminal activities. So we now have better laws, thanks to the legislature. I may be getting ahead of myself here, but in 2015, we partnered with Representative Kimberly Dudick from Missoula and brought House Bill 89, which is an agency bill that we drafted here, and the legislature passed and the governor signed it, and has much stiffer penalties and better definitions so that law enforcement officials can go after not only the perpetrators of trafficking, but the customers, if you will, as well.
Now, the Department of Justice budget is also under pressure in this budget session of the 2017 legislature, and I mean, you're looking at the potential of having your budget cut, and you might have to cur- not
necessarily stop, but at least reduce investigations. Is that correct?
You know, that's true. And of course, we're not the only agency that has to make cuts. But we do quite a bit with very little already. Certainly, cuts in law enforcement, I think, are not wise at this point in time. We've seen a rise in drug trafficking. We've seen a rise in human trafficking. And we have, you know, the people of Montana certainly need to be protected, if you will. So, you know, we'll work through that. We have very dedicated agents in DCI and Highway Patrol, the Forensic Science Lab and others, and they work very well with our partners across the state. And I think we'll tighten our belt to the extent we're told to, and we'll continue to try to do the best we can.
And it's still early, so I won't
That's
do
right.
too much gloom
the
and doom.
The jury is still deliberating.
Still deliberating, but I want to wrap up here and say that at least public awareness of the issue of human trafficking is taking place with the launch of an art exhibit that will open at the Capitol.
That's correct.
And, you know, what would you like to see, I guess, the message for Montanans who come to see the exhibit either in Helena or Billings, Kalispell, Missoula?
We need to talk about this as our communities, our churches, our businesses, with our family and friends. And people need to come to grips with the fact that human trafficking does occur and that these are real lives. These are people's, you know, brothers and sisters, their kids, et cetera. And Montanans, by our very nature, we're compassionate, we care. And so I hope that folks will be moved by the artwork that they see here at the Capitol on January 11th. And I hope that they will talk with others and become informed, learn the signs of human trafficking, which you can find on our website at DOJMT.gov. And if you see something suspicious, call law enforcement. But start talking about it and become aware and be that partner, if you will, with law enforcement to help these individuals be rescued.
Okay. And there is something that the average Montanan can do.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, one of the reasons we've seen a rise in the number of victims rescued. We've had an 83% rise in just 1 year, 2015 to 2016, in adult victims rescued, and a 400% rise in juvenile victims rescued. Now, whether that means more human trafficking going on or just people are more aware, probably a little bit of both.
Okay, so with that, we'll conclude. I want to thank you so much, State Attorney General Tim Fox. Thank you for sitting down in your office and talking with me.
Thank you, Jackie. I look forward to doing it again sometime soon.
In the 2015 session, Senator Diane Sand sponsored the bill to study sexual assault and was a member of that Law and Justice Interim Committee.
Thank you so much for coming in and talking with me about some of the work of the Law and Justice Interim Committee and the study, Senate Joint Resolution 24, Study of Sexual Assault in Montana. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Jackie. This has been an important topic to me for almost 50 years, and I was really delighted when a lot of national attention started to come around the issues of sexual assault in a way we haven't really seen in decades, and so I proposed a study topic for the Interim Committee on Law and Justice, which was prioritized, and so we spent about the last 18 months as the Law and Justice Committee looking at all aspects of sexual assault.
And was there something in particular that prompted you to take a look at what some have said are antiquated or perhaps not up-to-date laws regarding sexual assault?
Nothing so specific, but I would say the climate has changed, and that's what spurred me to do it. I've worked on this issue in the legislature and other places off and on for decades on everything from spousal sexual assault to starting sexual assault groups many years ago. But because between the president and particularly the Attorney General, Tim Fox, partly in conjunction with what's happened with the Department of Justice issues on the University of Montana campus, and over 150 other campuses in the United States, it seemed timely because there's energy and interest in it from a lot of parties.
And for folks who aren't familiar with the interim committee process, in some ways, doing these this study, this examination outside of the pressure cooker that's the normal 90-day scheduled session, do you think it gives the members of both the House and Senate a more contemplative time? You don't have some of the politics maybe that might interfere, or am I wrong?
Well put. Interim committees are generally less partisan, equal numbers of from both parties in the House and Senate. It's a great opportunity to look from kind of the 10,000-foot view at all kinds of aspects that may never end up in a bill, and to look at issues more in depth and to bring in a lot of people who can spend more than the 15 minutes we often spend on bills in the legislature. So, for example, in trying to look in the broadest way, I had people come in for the committee to talk about things like sexual assault on Indian reservations. I grew up on the Fort Peck Reservation, and it was very important for me to understand that approximately one in two Indian women are sexually assaulted in their lifetime. But the jurisdiction on reservations, because it's a federal crime, is a federal issue. And so the U.S. Attorney's Office came in and talked about that issue and the programs that they're doing, and several of the victim services people talked about it. And again, also the Title IX issue on campuses. We have no jurisdiction on that. It is actually an administrative process of Title IX of the Education Act. And so the Department of Justice at the federal level deals with that issue. And I wanted people on the committee to understand something about it, but it, in fact, is not something we have jurisdiction on. And thirdly, the military justice issue going on. And in the end, we ended up adopting the language that the Military Code of Justice currently uses in looking at what sexual assault is, which is the issue of consent, that a showing of a number of factors constitute consent, namely both a combination of words and actions that taken as a whole would lead one to believe there's consent. Because the current language around sexual assault, which is so seldom prosecuted successfully, even when somebody does go to law enforcement, which is not very often, is one that's is very much outdated. It actually goes back to right after the Constitutional Convention was approved in Montana. There was the Bar Association rewrote all of our criminal statutes. And so when they wrote it, it really reflected an antiquated view that it's really a property crime. Sexual assault in most countries has been initially a property crime against a husband or a father. And so it required the showing of force, and it also really incorporated the stereotypes and myths about sexual assault that many people had for years and some people still have. We all want to believe that we'd fight back. We all want to feel we'd do something. But I certainly know from having been in circumstances that get very uncomfortable and you just sort of freeze and you hope it goes away and don't want to deal with what's happening. And so we know that the latest research and decades of research into sexual assault and other kinds of forcible crimes is that the victim freezes. It's called a trauma-enforced response, and it's actually biological. And so you just hope you don't get killed or something worse happen to you or that it just will stop. And so the Montana law that requires a showing of you have to prove that you were forced when you, in fact, weren't forced in that way is antiquated. And in fact, the Montana Supreme Court has several times said, yeah, it's a rape, but it doesn't meet Montana statutes. And so because of that, we need to update that particular core part of it that really gets away with the requirement for showing of force and goes to this consent language, which is currently being used by the military in a number of other states. Then we've also created an aggravated sexual assault provision where there is force being used that has a higher penalty.
Right. And there might be some confusion. I've heard generally it's males who are saying, again, she didn't fight back, it was consensual, and I'm afraid that, you know, I might be in a relationship where there's retaliation, where then there are allegations of rape. So how do you protect both the, you know, alleged perpetrator and, as well as the alleged victim?
And in
under,
our country,
under these updated
with our commitments in the justice system, that's a very important question, because in the end, the changes we're proposing do not change the burden of proof. In the end, when a victim comes to law enforcement, they investigate it. Then a county attorney looks at it and has to say, is there enough evidence here to actually bring a charge, which can be difficult. And then it goes to a jury, and the jury has to convict beyond a reasonable doubt. It's the highest standard that we have for burden of proof. This law does not change that at all. So I believe we still are absolutely protecting for false accusations, which nationally are about 2%, the same as it is for any other felony. So I know people think there are a lot of these false accusations, but, you know, a lot of that gets weeded out way down the line, and it's really not the factor people think it is. I would say the injustice is for the thousands of women who have been sexually assaulted and who don't bring that charge even to the police for investigation because people question she goes on trial instead of the perpetrator. Now, we know we have many different levels of perpetrators, and my concern, and it was also brought to me by a member of the Supreme Court, was to look at how do we deal with offenders. Let's get smart about that, too. What does research show us? The fact of the matter is the majority of people who are convicted of sexual assault are not long-term serious threats to our community. And so we do treatment of sex offenders. We have a program for that. It's very effective. And then afterwards, we evaluate offenders to go on the sex registry. Are they are at very low level of risk, moderate risk, or high risk? Let's put our attention and our money at keeping track of people who are moderate and high risk. And those that are at low risk, if after a period of time they are still good members of the community, let's take them off the sex registry. Let them get a job. Let them live in a house, live in a community. It does not serve our interest in the long run to just put all people, regardless, on that sex registry.
Are you referring to the case of the district judge in Glasgow regarding what some in the community felt was a very lenient sentence? And he said he was just following Montana statute.
Well, we're looking at, we have seven pieces of legislation coming out of the study, and they address all kinds of things from a correction in the incest statute to how do we deal with offenders to the basic prosecution of it, as well as things as a hole we discovered in the process, which is for a child that's conceived of a sexual assault when the rapist retains parental rights. There needs to be a way to terminate those parental rights if the judge believes there is, again, compelling evidence. So protecting the rights of both parties, but actually giving victims access to justice in this state while protecting the public safety. Those are the primary issues that we have here. And so I think this package taken as a whole, it'll undergo some revision. Some of it may not survive, but my hope is that the core of it will survive because it is good, contemporary, best practices for the state of Montana. It will protect our citizenry, hold people accountable, and do the right thing.
Certainly, these are committee bills, so there was an opportunity, perhaps, to build those coalitions between party lines, between chambers.
Mm-hmm.
So are you, I guess it's still early in the process, but hopeful that this package of seven bills?
I'm hopeful that most of them will pass. We have two bills starting in the House, but five bills are starting in the Senate. We've already heard those five bills, and they will go forward. I must also say, when you're talking about coalitions, the partnerships have been phenomenal in this area. I'll give a real shout-out to our Attorney General, Tim Fox, who has been an enormous advocate for redressing these issues. He has done a very good job of creating a curriculum that trains prosecutors and investigators in how to deal with these issues. We submitted a letter of support for a grant that he was successful in getting from the federal government for the testing of what are known as rape kits, DNA, which is an important issue, particularly when you have cases that address another one of our bills, which is the statute of limitations. Particularly young kids that are offended against frequently repress those memories for good reason. They're not safe. It could be a family member that's assaulted them. And so we have statutes of limitations for sexual assault that are different than some other crimes. And currently it's 10 years after the age of 18. And our proposal is to raise that to at least 20, although I think it could come off altogether, particularly when you've got a DNA kit that comes up later as testing by someone who has committed multiple offenses. These are the folks we're really trying to track down, the ones who do multiple offenses. They're, you know, and they groom young victims, both male and female. They groom them. So force is often not involved. The victim may not even realize till much later that they in fact, were sexually assaulted. They don't frame it that way until they hear it later and go, oh, my God, that's what happened to me. And so you want to give them the opportunity to still pursue and prosecute that case, could be decades later.
Right. I'm wondering about the general conversation that we're having. This country tends to be of a Puritan nature, and so topics like this, to talk about it so openly, tends to be uncomfortable. I guess your hope, you know, bringing forth these bills and starting this public conversation in this public building, the Capitol.
Well, this conversation is timely because, as I've said, everyone from President Obama created a task force on it. You know, I think it's so important that men stand up and say, we're not doing this anymore. Those of us who have worked with victims for decades, my first ones were back in the 60s, we will be dealing with victims forever if we don't go upstream and start to put a stop to it. And one way to do that is to be much clearer in what is required in sexual relationships for consent. So you get, I mean, there's no question when you've got a second grade teacher abusing a child, those kinds of cases. But as people get a little bit older, the question of, is it a he said, she said, that's where it's important, and you start seeing advertisements at a TV, at a movie I was at recently. If you don't have consent, you don't have consent. You know, being really clear about what that is. So the leadership of people like President Obama, Tim Fox, the football coach, when those men stand up and say, here's what it means, you have to have consent. This is what it means. And if you don't do that, we will we'll deal with it in really serious ways. We're not going to joke it off. We're not going to laugh about it. We're going to deal with it. And so I am very heartened after these many decades that we are going to change part of this problem in terms of how common this is. You know, one in five women suffer from this in their life, 50% of them when they're under 25. You know, I mean, it's most common when you're young, you're vulnerable, you don't know what you're getting into, you're in riskier situations, but it still could happen to anyone, regardless of race, age, no matter how much training you've had in self-defense, it does not matter. You know, women are more often victims of this. Occasionally, men certainly are, as we know from cases like the Landusky case, particularly in case of a coach who may decide to be predatory with kids, young males. It happens. It happens in the military. It happens other places. But it's time for us to stop. I mean, really. No child deserves to have their life destroyed in that particular way that sexual assault does, and no adult does either. And these bills as a whole will go a long way to both giving the message out to the public that we're taking this seriously, but also to give the tools to our prosecutors and our investigators. I mean, it breaks my heart to talk to my prosecutors at home who tell me, I had this case and I cried and I had to tell her, you know, it doesn't meet the standard to be able to prosecute it. I can't prosecute it. And the victim brought the prosecutor flowers. She felt so bad. You know, I mean, that happens. It happens all the time. And so it's really important that we, like we do in so many other areas of our statutes, update them, do best practices, see what really is out there and how it works. And I'm just proud to have the support of so many other members of the legislature and of the Attorney General and other people who've worked on this for so long.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. But I want to thank you so much, Senator Diane Sands, who is a member of the Law and Justice Interim Committee that helped work on these bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie.
You've been listening to Capital Connections. I'm Jackie Yamanaka. Our theme music is by the Alex Nauman Trio. Capital Connections is a production of YPR News.